Well, the Earth Summit has certainly brought into the public arena again the debate about the developing world and the role of those of us who live in the West, in the developed world, in encouraging that development. The pressure upon our planet, which the Earth Summit has been all about, has brought that into sharper focus, because we can see now we're not going to get the vital cooperation we need from third world nations if we don't respond generously to their aspirations for a standard of living that is closer to our own. But there are all kinds of questions and controversies that are bound up in this debate, that lie behind George Bush's reluctance to sign certain parts of the treaty and Britain's reluctance to sign other parts, and which fueled the whole controversy that was going on in Rio. Two in particular that I think, if you haven't already picked up on, as Christians you should be very clearly aware of for your praying and for your thinking. The first big debate is the argument about economic growth. And to be put simply, was Thomas Malthus right? Malthus was one of the first people to propound a kind of doomsday scenario for our world. He pointed out that population tends to grow in geometric progression, whereas economies grow, he said, by arithmetic progression. This means population is bound to outstrip economic growth, and so there's got to be a crisis sooner or later. Famine, war. Over the years, there's been a huge amount of debate about whether Malthus was right about this, because he predicted his crisis 100 years ago or more, and it never happened. The reason it never happened is twofold. First, he completely underestimated the success of the Green Revolution, as it's been called. The ability of the world to feed itself has, in fact, increased faster than the world population in the last 100 years. We can now, at least potentially, feed not just the population of the world we have, but a population several times bigger than we have. Malthus didn't believe that was possible. He grossly underestimated technological advance in the area of agriculture and food production. The other thing he didn't realize was that as economies grow, as mortality rates in young children decline and so on, as people's standard of living goes up, so the birth rate falls. People don't feel it's necessary to have as many children because the children they do have survive. And there's an incentive for them to have fewer children so they can give a better quality of life to those they do have. He didn't realize that would happen. In the West, at any rate, we now have a pretty stable population, even in some countries a declining one. Some countries are more worried about the fact that their populations are falling than they're growing. It's the increase in the elderly population rather than the burgeoning population of among the young, which is their real anxiety. But is that going to be the continuing story? There are many people today who some call neo-Malthusians, who are reiterating Malthus's warnings. They're saying the population is still growing, especially in the developing world, at a rate the world cannot possibly sustain. These developing countries cannot possibly sustain the standard of living they want if they're doubling their population as often as they are at present. Furthermore, they say, many of the resources that we use for economic development are non-renewable. We are running out of them. So eventually, economic development must slow up and become much more expensive to pursue as these resources become rare. Back in 1972, an important report from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology was very significant in highlighting this kind of doomsday scenario a la Malthus, limits to growth it was called. And then in 1980, the Global 2000 report to the president was similarly pessimistic. But in the last 10 or 20 years, there have also been a very strong anti-Malthusian lobby who said that this Malthusian doomsday scenario is quite wrong. It isn't the way it works. These neo-Malthusians are making exactly the same mistake that Malthus made. They're underestimating technology. They're underestimating the fact that the birth rate is going to start falling as people's economies improve. One big book, which was published, I think, about 6 years ago, The Resourceful Earth, takes apart this pessimistic Global 2000 report that I mentioned
and argues very, very firmly that in fact there are plenty of resources left in the world, and that where even those which may run out in the foreseeable future, we shall find alternatives for. The population trends are not as depressing as some make out. That in fact the population of the world will stabilize in 10 or 20 years' time. And that in fact the future is very rosy for the 21st century. Well, who's right? If I was an expert in these areas, I perhaps could have some opinion about which of them is right. But actually, I'm not sure anybody knows. There are some very powerful names arraigned on both sides of this particular debate. The other big controversy that's going on, which is all tied up with what went on at Rio, is the argument about economic equality. And that can be put simply this way. Was Karl Marx's critique of capitalism right? Karl Marx insisted that a great deal of poverty was the result of oppression and exploitation, which resulted from Western capitalism. An imperialist kind of model of international trade, left-wingers have argued, is responsible for poverty in many of the developing world. And the redistribution of wealth is a moral priority because it's just unfair that these nations should have less than the developed world does. But again, there have been many on the right wing who have repudiated that ultimately, and insist that Karl Marx and those who follow his analysis are hopelessly astray, victim to a kind of socialist ideology, which doesn't have any real rational scientific foundation. In fact, they insist inequality is not in itself unfair. The reason that so-called developing nations are poor has very little to do, they say, with patterns of international trade or with the exploitations of Western capitalism. It has much more to do with ignorance, with religions which lack any kind of work ethic, with the internal politics of these nations, which are often far more unequal and elitist than anything the West can display, and of course with the recurrent fact of war, which has been pursued in many developing countries with a quite insane persistence. Well, what's the truth of this matter? Is the economic inequality between the North and the South, between the developed world and the underdeveloped world, or the developing world, as we prefer to call it these days, is that something we should feel conscience-stricken about? Should we feel it's our fault in some way? Or is it truer to say that the fault, if there is fault, lies with these peoples themselves? Again, there's a big diversity of opinion. If I was an expert, I might be able to give you an informed opinion on the matter. But again, there are big names arraigned on both sides. And Christians have taken up sides on both sides of that debate too. What can we say then about this whole question of poverty in developing countries? I think there's one thing we can say. Whoever is to blame, whether it's the people themselves, or the West, or nobody. And whether the opportunity for further economic growth holds hope that we will actually eradicate poverty in the 21st century, or not. Whatever your opinions about these things, poverty exists. And it is very clear in the Bible, both in the Old and the New Testaments, but that is something Christians should be concerned about. Not necessarily that they should say it's their fault or take the blame for it, but that in compassion they should be concerned about it. I want to look at three classic Christian responses to poverty. From various ways, they are all being recommended by different groups and parties today within the Christian church and have an influence on this whole debate, at least a Christian dimension to it. One classic response to the phenomenon of poverty, which you can find going right back to the very earliest days of the church, is technically called asceticism. Asceticism is the voluntary adoption of poverty. It's one, as I say, of the earliest responses to the embarrassment of riches, which one finds in the church. The reasons, the motivations for asceticism in the very early church were actually mixed. Some of it probably derived from certain aspects of Greek philosophy that tended to undervalue the human body, treated as something of less significance than the spirit, and that by denying the body you were actually enhancing your spirituality. Some, too, was motivated by a kind of pietistic desire to imitate Jesus Christ. Francis of Assisi, I suppose, is one of the most moving examples of that. Perhaps you know the story of how he heard a voice telling him to rebuild a certain chapel, promptly sold his father's home and clothes in order to give money to the priest for this purpose. When his father wasn't very sympathetic to having his clothes and home sold in this way, he took his son to the bishop, and whereupon, being rebuked by the bishop, Francis stripped off all his garments and money, gave them to the bishop in compensation for his crime, and walked out into the winter snow wearing only a hair shirt. So the story of Francis and his voluntary adoption of poverty, in order to identify with the poor and in order to imitate Christ, was begun. So asceticism has a number of different strands flowing into it, some of them more obviously founded in the gospel and in Christian thinking than others. I think one has to say, though, that this world-denying kind of response to poverty isn't something you can really justify from the New Testament as a general practice for Christians. It lacks New Testament warrant. It's certainly true, of course, that Jesus called some of his early disciples to a life of renunciation of wealth. Sell what you have and give to the poor. Come, follow me, he told the rich young ruler. But that was not a general command he issued to all his disciples, and it wasn't something, certainly, which all the early Christians did. In fact, there's a considerable amount of resistance to asceticism in the epistles of the New Testament. Paul recognizes the kind of Greek pagan influence which sometimes informed this desire to be an ascetic and resist it in epistles like the Epistle to the Colossians. One important passage in this regard is 1 Timothy 4, verse 4, where Paul explicitly warns that asceticism would be the mark of the church at the end of the apostolic age. He says, people will arise who will forbid people to marry and order them to abstain from certain foods, which God created to be received with thanksgiving, he says, by those who believe and know the truth. For everything God created is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving. I think it's quite clear that Paul there is engaging in apologetic against some of the extremes of the ascetic movement, which later, of course, became the monastic movement of the early church. Nevertheless, asceticism does have something to teach us. It may be right that we reduce our lifestyles in some way in order to have more freedom to share with the poor. Looked at in that way, asceticism, a decision to have a simpler lifestyle than you could perhaps afford in order to have more surpluses to share, is something which could certainly be defended from the New Testament. You may remember the story of John Wesley, who made a practice of living on the same amount of money which he lived on at a very early stage in his life. He just didn't allow his standard of living to increase as he got wealthier. Instead, he just gave more and more and more away. So he began by giving away perhaps 20%. And a few years later, when he was earning more but still living on the same, he was able to give away 50%. Towards the end of his life, he was able to give away nearly everything he earned. And there have been other notable Christians who followed a similar ethic of graduated tithe, as it's sometimes called. Another classic Christian response to poverty is communalism. Communalism means the group sharing of material resources in order to produce a greater economic equality. In our day, of course, it's become a major secular response to poverty in Marxism and socialism.
But it does have a very strong Christian dimension to it as well. In fact, many of the early socialists were Christians rather than Marxists or atheists. You can trace it back in history into the monasteries, and perhaps most interestingly for us, to the Anabaptists of the 16th century. These were radicals in the Reformation who were persecuted by both the Catholics and the Protestants. Nobody liked the Anabaptists. They persecuted nobody, on the other hand, because they were pacifists. And in addition to being pacifists, they were also communalists, at least some of them were. The Hutterites, in particular, the followers of Jacob Hutter, were those who literally tried to conform to the practice of the early church, as we find it in the book of Acts, chapter 2 and chapter 4. We read there that the early Christians had everything in common, that many of them sold their possessions and brought the proceeds of those sales to the apostles so that they could be distributed amongst those who were poor, particularly the widows in the community. Once again, I think one has to say, whilst there's something very admirable about this kind of communalism, the sharing of wealth within the Christian community, it's not something which you can find biblical warrant for making a general rule of. Even in the early church, it's quite clear that this was an entirely voluntary practice on the part of the early Christians. They weren't forced to do it. In fact, Acts 5 makes that quite clear. Ananias and Sapphira, who were disciplined in the early church for lying to the apostles about a receipt of some money, but were not being penalized because they wouldn't cooperate with a sort of enforced communism, a sort of enforced redistribution of wealth. No, the judgment fell on them because they had lied to the Holy Spirit, we're told. What Peter actually says to them was, the field that you sold was at your disposal, nobody made you sell it. And even after it was sold, the money that was realized from it was at your disposal, nobody grabbed it from you or insisted that you had to contribute it. So there was no reason for you to feel you had to tell lies about it. You could have had the field, you could have had the money, it was yours to do with as you wanted. So it was quite clear there was no compulsory program of redistribution of wealth going on in the early church. It was, as we shall see in a moment, something much closer to Christian charity, free people doing what they wanted with their own goods. And it's important that it's not misrepresented. But having said that, there is again something we can learn from that communal model. Although that sort of communalistic practice is not something we find generally within the early church. It is also important perhaps to note that that kind of communalism didn't protect the church at Jerusalem from poverty, because a few years later, the church at Jerusalem was one of the most poor churches in the ancient world, and Christians from Greece had to make a contribution in order to help them. But even though that communalistic model was never a general pattern of church life, what you do find later on in the New Testament is one church, which is wealthy, assisting another church, which is poor. The classic example of that is found in 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9, where the Macedonian believers take up a collection to assist their poor brothers and sisters in Jerusalem. Now again, this seems to me something which is very applicable to today. In a small way, we've tried as a church here to create some kind of similar link. When a team of our members, you remember, went out to Mexico, to the Armonia project there in Mexico City, taking with them not just a gift, but also manpower to try and help the congregation there. That kind of link between two churches seems to me a very positive way in which Christians today can respond to the challenge of poverty in a way that really expresses our unity in Jesus Christ and our mutual care for one another. So asceticism, that's one response. You can't turn it into a general rule, but it does have something to teach us. Communalism, that again, you can't turn into a general response, though it does have something to teach us. There is, however, one response, which you find all through the history of the church, which you cannot deny is mandated both in the Old and the New Testaments, in a quite unmistakable way. And that's the response of charity. The response of asceticism is the voluntary renunciation of property in order to identify with the poor. The response of communalism is the voluntary sharing of the ownership of property with the poor in order to produce a greater equality. And I say, whilst both can claim some Bible texts in their support, they lack a really convincing but biblical basis. At least there's anything more than the special calling of a few. But charity, which is the voluntary donation of wealth to relieve the poor, is quite unambiguously taught. Let me read to you some verses from Deuteronomy 15, which are important in this connection. I'm reading from Deuteronomy 15, verse 7. If there is a poor man among your brothers in any of the towns of the land that the Lord your God is giving you, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted toward your poor brother. Rather be open-handed and freely lend him whatever he needs. Be careful not to harbor this wicked thought. The seventh year, the year of cancelling debts, is near, so that you do not show ill will toward your needy brother and give him nothing. He may then appeal to the Lord against you, and you will be found guilty of sin. Now give generously to him, and do so without a grudging heart. Then because of this, the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in everything you put your hand to. There will always be poor people in the land. Therefore I command you to be open-handed toward your brothers and toward the poor and needy in your land. There can be little doubt then that there is a biblical obligation laid upon us in God's law to give. This is not to say that charity has not been opposed by some. There has been a school of thought that regards charity as making matters worse. I mentioned Thomas Malthus. He was one person who believed that charity was a bad thing. Because he believed that population always outrun the growth of production, he felt that feeding the hungry would only encourage them to breed more. And so multiply the problem of shortage and bring about the crisis more speedily. You find, in some respects, a not dissimilar idea in Adam Smith, the founder of capitalist economics, who holds the view that charity merely rewards laziness and so depresses the production side of the economy, doesn't encourage people to produce the wealth that might relieve their poverty. There's even a fellow like Herbert Spencer, who was an extreme evolutionist, who argued that the death of the poor was simply a particular case of the survival of the fittest and should be encouraged as nature's way. Well, there are obvious flaws in all this thinking, but there are still, as I say, neo-Malthusians who you will sometimes hear arguing in a not dissimilar way. A fellow called Garrett Hardin in 1970 wrote an article called Lifeboat Ethics, in which he said there was a case against helping the poor. Because each rich country, he said, was a kind of lifeboat. And if we waste our limited resources on the hungry masses in the water, then we will all starve together tomorrow. Very narrow-minded sort of point of view, you might say. But one which still finds its advocates even today. I don't think, though, those kinds of arguments can hold any kind of water with a Christian. Charity is something, according to the book of Deuteronomy, which is not just a kind of rational response to the problem. It's a moral duty laid upon us by God. God doesn't say you have to exercise your brain as to whether it's a good idea to help this poor man or not. I'm telling you, you ought to help him. There is a moral duty in this matter. It's not an option, it's a command. The basis of this giving is interesting. The basis of it, if you read this chapter carefully, is that all property belongs to God, ultimately. We are only stewards of it, really. And therefore we are responsible to use those resources in the way God requires. Though we may talk about private property, the Bible does not actually teach private property in the pure libertarian capitalist sense. It talks about the accountable stewardship of property, not the outright ownership of it. And since God insists that we have a responsibility to the poor, it is a moral obligation of us to use his wealth, which he's given us to steward, to help them. What's more, says Deuteronomy 15, there is a blessing, a reward for being obedient in this matter. A blessing, no doubt, first of all, in spirit, because as Jesus himself said, it is always more blessed to give than to receive. A generous person will always be a happier and more liberated person than a miserly and parsimonious person is. But it may very well be, too, that the Bible would give some warrant for saying that there will be material blessings, practical blessings, economic blessings, even, to those who are generous with what they have. Certainly the Old Testament argues, without embarrassment, that God will compensate those who bring the full tithes into the storehouse. And even Jesus was not above saying that those who make sacrifices for his sake will be compensated in this world as well as in the world to come. Seek first God's kingdom, he said, and all these things will be added unto you. The other thing to note is about Deuteronomy 15, of course, which relates in some way to what we were saying earlier, is that it seems to anticipate there will be a continual need, a permanent need for charity. Verse 11, there will always be poor people in the land. I don't think it really matters what your politics are, what your views are on that vexed question of economic growth and of economic equality. Some aspects of human need are simply not amenable to political or technological solutions. Orphans, the blind, the lame, the homeless, the widows, the unemployed, the demented. There will always be poor people. No matter how successful we are at structuring our economies to be more equal, or structuring our technologies to produce all the wealth we need to share. Because there will always be people who are the victims of misfortune, Christian duty remains, right till the end of time, to be open-handed towards your brothers, toward the poor and the needy in your land. There will always be poor people, he says. Of course, one does have to face the fact that sometimes handouts can be less than advantageous to those to whom they're given. Even here we have the problem, don't we, quite often, of people who are homeless coming around after the service begging for a little cash. And I expect you, like me, have difficulty knowing how you should respond. Sometimes there's a distinct smell of alcohol on the breath that makes you wonder where that money will go if you put it into their hand. Maybe it is wiser to think about some kind of gift in kind rather than just giving cash, to make sure they really do eat or even find a bed for the night, rather than just seek in their weakness the easy consolation of a bottle. And in the same kind of way, there may well be a responsibility on the donor to try to trace the way in which the gift is put to use when it comes to helping developing countries and the poor of other cultures. It may not be a good idea to simply give handouts. That may well create an attitude of dependency, a kind of paternalism. It may well simply feed the inequalities, the internal inequalities, which already exist in those countries, as elites keep hold of that aid money, and it doesn't really trickle down to the poorest strata in the community. It can also be the case, of course, sometimes, that what we call overseas aid is a form of exploitation which simply creates a demand for Western-style goods supplied by Western-based companies. And there's been plenty of examples of that, those of us who've lived in the third world. No, there may very well be, I'm sure there is, a case for intelligent giving, for thinking about the way we're giving and tracing the gift, rather than just pouring it in some careless way into the pockets of poorer nations. And it may very well be that the debate about growth is something we have to consider when it comes to just how we encourage developing countries to develop. A lot does depend on whether we believe growth is something the world can safely pursue without limit, or whether it is something, as the Malthusians say, we have to put some kind of constraint upon if we're not to ruin the world for our grandchildren. Perhaps you know that little piece from Alice in Wonderland. Alice felt a curious sensation. She was beginning to grow larger again. "I wish you wouldn't squeeze, sir," said the Dormouse. "I can hardly breathe." "I can't help it," said Alice very meekly. "I'm growing." "Well, you've no right to grow here," said the Dormouse. "Don't talk nonsense," said Alice more boldly. "You know you're growing too." "Yes, but I grow at a reasonable pace," said the Dormouse, "not in that ridiculous fashion." It's a kind of paradigm, isn't it, of the debate between the developing and the developed countries. How fast can we safely grow? Is it right for one group of nations to grow faster than other nations can possibly do? Is it not just going to squeeze the whole global resources of growth? This is an important debate, and I'm not saying I know the answer to it. And it makes a difference to the kind of charity which we decide to give. That's really, I think, what lies behind a lot of the debate that's been exercising the minds of some of the major donor nations at Rio. They think, perhaps, that some of the developing countries have a rather simplistic attitude to development and what's good for the world. They want to think more cautiously about how much they give and what sort of causes they give to. They want to make sure that the gift that is given is appropriately used and thus doesn't make the problem worse. And I think that's a perfectly fair concern to have. But if what we are seeing in the reluctance of some of the major nations of the West to sign, to pledge, is an actual reluctance to be generous, why then I think as Christians we have to protest. We have to say there is a responsibility upon us, not just because we are Christians, but because we are human. Not laid upon us by the New Testament, but by the law of God. There is a responsibility upon us to give to the poor. God will judge those who refuse to do so. Jesus warned of that in most solemn terms, didn't he? "I will come and judge among the nations," he says. "And I will say to them, inasmuch as you did it not to me, to them, you did it not to me." Sins of omission in this matter of charity and compassion and care for the poor, Jesus says, will be held against us on the last day. We shall be judged for them. But we're not talking here about optional extras. We're not talking about works of supererogation. We're talking about a moral duty laid upon us by our Creator. Let's think of it in that way and pray about it in that way.